Rare earth minerals. They've become quite a priority for the U.S. as of late, have they not? Well, maybe you've been aware of as of late, but it goes a little bit deeper than that, as we're about to explore. These are natural resources, which are crucial for the areas of, let's see, technology, military, energy, transportation, and you get the idea. Pretty important stuff, and valuable, too. While it at least appears that the U.S. is ramping up on moving on rare earth minerals, as my next guest writes, China has long held a commanding lead regarding these crucial materials. So how is China putting that dominance to use? And can the U.S. catch up and close the gap? He writes about all this in his new book, Mineral War, China's Quest for Weapons of Mineral Destruction. He's a portfolio manager of a critical minerals investment fund at Amvest Capital, geopolitical analyst and host of the podcast Tyranny Today, Thomas Nadrowski. Thanks for being here today, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Two websites, themineralwar.com, and learn more about Amvest Capital, amvestcapital.com. And we do have those links over at our homepage. Real fast, primary for the novice in all this, what are rare earth minerals and why are they so important in the 21st century?
So rare earth minerals are 17 different elements in the table of elements that you'll remember from school, probably, or hopefully.
Yes.
they were hidden at the bottom, not very visible, and they tend to co-occur in nature, which is one reason why they're a little complex, more complex to extract and process than other minerals. In fact, we should call them rare earth elements rather than minerals, because minerals are different conglomerates that you find in subsoil from which you mine them, and then you have to refine them and separate them, and this is what's different with rare earths. You have to separate them into different oxides, some of which are very valuable and others are less valuable, but you still have to separate them, and that increases the cost of operating a rare earth facility. So this is the first problem of this. The second problem is that they're often associated with radionuclides. So radioactive materials such as thorium and uranium. In many countries, jurisdictions do not allow for simply unregulated processing or transportation or handling of these materials. That's also the case of the United States, where Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and back in the 1980s, tightened the regulations, which means that essentially a thorium of 0.05% was considered class 7 material, and that increased the cost of production and mining of rare earths. And essentially, we can date maybe early 1990s, late 1980s, the beginning of the death of the American rare earth industry. And slowly, but very confidently, China has taken over in the 1990s throughout the entire value chain, including mining. That's because of very attractive geology that southern China has, and the so-called Yangtze Craton. That might surprise some of listeners, but southern China, actually geologically, is part of a southern hemisphere of Gondwana supercontinent. So when you hear about mining in South America, Africa, or Australia, sort of par excellence regions of the world where there's a lot of mining and a lot of metal mining, well, southern China belongs to the same category, geologically speaking. So there was an endowment from day one, naturally, mineralization. But mineralization has to be transformed into resources to reserves, and that has to be mined and processed. That processing technology was imported by China from the West and subsequently monopolized, because most of the Western jurisdictions were not comfortable with very environmentally damaging mining that rare earth involves. So that's a story, and it's a story that's been going on for 30 years. Now, of course, we're waking up, as you mentioned, to the vital role that these materials play in permanent magnets and sensors and optoelectronics and so on. And it turns out China monopolizes them and does not shy away from weaponizing access to these materials, which is precisely the problem we're facing right now.
Along with their obviously close proximity to a massive raw material supply, their ability to refine it, thanks to the West, another stab in the heart for that one. How much does the China system of government and lack of freedom and forced labor, I mean, the list can go on from there. How valuable was that in how China gained the command and the leadership in the rare earth mineral environment?
Yeah, so this is a good question. I'm going into some detail about this in the book. There are several reasons for Chinese leadership today, or dominance, if you wish. We believed, the capital markets in the U.S., for a long time that inevitably, somehow, China will follow the pathway of liberal economies, following their access to World Trade Organization in 2001. This might or might not have been the plan in Beijing, but certainly since 2006, back then the premier was Wen Jiabao in Beijing, China decided to go back into something that they were very good at, industrial policies. So top-down planning of, which industry should be successful, which industry is, promising growth, giving the technological changes and so on. There were several iterations of this. And the real break from our model, our capital market founded model, occurred after the great financial crisis. Essentially, China decided to control big parts of the industry. It was easier to do upstream. Of course, mining and refining are different nodes in the larger value chains, which are upstream, where the Communist Party and state-owned enterprises were dominant anyway. There was some private business, especially in rare earths in the South, smaller operators. And in 2010, there was the first episode of a conflict over elements between China and Japan, and China tried to weaponize that this trade and was successful for about 2 months. But Chinese smugglers managed to export and ship some material to Japan because the prices, of course, skyrocketed around the world when the material was not available. And Japan is the largest largest customer for both Chinese permanent rare earth magnets as well as rare earth oxides. And so since that experience, so 2010, China decided to tighten the system and as much as possible nationalize the entire rare earth industry and make sure that there is no leakage in future. And there were certain steps, but it accelerated right after the COVID pandemic in 2020 when China promulgated a new law called Export Control Law, and this was October 2020. I actually started the fund, AMVAS, Terra Dyn Critical Minerals Fund, when that legislation was passed, because, of course, that raised the issue of potential restrictions on shipments of this material to other trade partners, as it was the case 10 years before during that spat with Japan. And that's precisely what has happened. So the last 2 or 3 years, we had a whole series of regulations in China constraining or controlling more severely different flows of different materials, not just rare earths, but also tungsten, antimony, graphite, gallium, germanium, and others that you occasionally may hear in the headlines. Very important as dual-use materials. So some of the uses are for the military, some for the civilian market. And this came to a head eventually in 2025, last year, when China decided to use that dominance as a pushback against the U.S. approach to rebalance our trade with China and sort of rebalance the very lopsided relationship between, our current account deficit and the huge current account surplus that China maintains, not only vis-a-vis U.S., but also many other partners. So that's sort of a longer story, but it's been in gestation for a while.
And we are in time with Thomas Nodarsky, who's written, the author of The Mineral War, China's Quest for Weapons of Mineral Destruction, themineralwar.com, the website you're listening to, Issues and Ideas. Just to wrap up, earlier segment, we were talking about energy shortages with electricity, and I mentioned the mantra, drill, baby, drill. Is the U.S. too entrapped by our own doing on 20th century thinking of oil versus the 21st century thinking of rare earth minerals? Because I know we have a deal with Ukraine. How's the mining industry in Ukraine these days? We have a deal with, hopefully, to get rare earth out of Venezuela if the miners don't get their throats cut. Greenland, deal there, but even China couldn't get anything of significance out of Greenland. What's one of the major first steps that the U.S. has to do to start thinking 21st century needs and raw materials and energy?
Excellent question, at least two questions I see here. First, regarding our bilateral deals with different countries, I think that's positive. Unfortunately, you know, America First in geology doesn't work very well because it cannot onshore that very well. So, yes, we are dependent on our partners. And that, you know, there's a whole slew of agreements that this administration signed with Japan and Korea, which are important refiners, with Australia and other mining countries, also with DRC and Ukraine. Some of these are long-dated. Greenland definitely, you know, has very attractive mineralization, but mining is not for tomorrow. There's a reason why there are only two mines in Greenland, and none of them produces critical minerals. But the second question you ask about oil, and that's a very interesting one. I also allude to this in my book. Oil investment is very different, and we have a capital market that's very well attuned to the needs of the oil business. It's, you know, high depletion, heavy capex, but short duration investment. So you get to cash relatively quickly. And this is what the private market actually really liked, and a lot of leverage is possible to do. And oil wells can respond to the needs of shareholders really quickly, whether to pay out dividends or reinvest the money into another well. In minerals, it doesn't work like this. Let's leave aside rare earths with all the regulatory problems. To build a large copper mine takes about 15 years. 15 years. And to explore for copper or zinc or rare earths, for that matter, or lithium or anything else, you have to spend many years without cash. So you need an equity market with low cost of capital. And for this, we probably need to overhaul our tax system to attract U.S. capital to companies that exist in other jurisdictions where there is a much more successful mining industry, such as Australia, Canada, UK. And these are the countries which have with us an agreement embedded in our legislation called Defense Production Act, Title III, because materials from those countries are considered domestic source for our military, for our national security. So I think there's a lot of homework to be done, and I hope that, you know, we are on the right path, but this is a long journey ahead.
For you listening, we've talked a lot in recent months about rare earth minerals, but what Thomas does with mineral wars, he brings a more wide scope and understanding through the history, through the transitions, through the stumbles and even outright failures of response to what China has been so strongly progressing and growing in, that you'll gain an understanding, a much more better understanding through the education that he offers with Mineral Wars. Again, you can find out more at themineralwar.com and learn more about Amvest Capital, amvestcapital.com. Thomas Nodrowski, you bring the understanding of the importance of something that needs to be understood as being important, and congratulations on doing that with your book. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.